Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and tonight's installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. Today is Tuesday, May 26th in the year 2020, many people considering it the worst year of their life, but hey, I guess things could always be worse, right? So let's not maybe go that far, but I'm glad to have you with me tonight. Tom Merrill here. Like to thank Fire Engineering Chief Bobby Halton again for supporting these podcasts and the shows. Without any of these people or these organizations, we wouldn't be able to bring you these podcasts. So thank you so much to them. And there's so many great podcasts, so many great hosts, so many great topics. There's something for everybody in the fire service, that's for sure. And as you know, there's podcasts for every type of job and everything that people like to do. And so I appreciate you taking your time out to listen to my podcast because, hey, as volunteers, time is a great commodity and you're taking the time to listen in. And thank you very much for listening to my podcast, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, which is dedicated to the volunteer fire service and the issues and the challenges and stories about our great volunteer fire service. It's a show that's dedicated to firefighters who support our mission statement, paid or volunteer, it doesn't matter. It's dedicated to those firefighters who support the mission statement that being considered a professional firefighter has absolutely nothing to do with earning a paycheck and everything to do with delivering competent and compassionate service and taking care of not only our customers, those people that we're out there serving and protecting, but also taking care of our own members as well. That's what professional is all about. So this show is actually a show for all firefighters, those who truly believe that developing and maintaining and upholding a professional reputation is the duty and responsibility of anybody wearing that title, firefighter, paid or volunteer. Just one quick housekeeping note for this evening. I usually start off with a bunch of things, what's going on in the fire service. I just want to let you know, obviously a lot of shows and a lot of conferences have been canceled, especially some of the big ones, or maybe postponed. And one of the organizations that I talk quite a bit about on this show, because they are dedicated to the volunteer fire service, is the National Volunteer Fire Council. And they do a great training summit every year. It's phenomenal. I presented at it a couple of times. I was due to present at it again this year. They obviously also postponed their summit. It was supposed to be at the end of June, and they just announced it's going to be rescheduled for May of 2021 back in Orlando, where it was supposed to be this year. It was supposed to be June 26th and 27th. But they're doing something pretty cool this year, and they're still going to offer a virtual training summit with snippets and information on the different programs that they were offering. So I'd encourage you to check it out. Go on NVFC, which stands for National Volunteer Fire Council, nvfc.org/summit, and you'll get all sorts of information on that. And if you can, make plans to go to that summit next year, May 21st and 22nd down in Orlando, because it is a phenomenal summit with great instructors, great information, and it's dedicated to the volunteer fire service. And you can walk away with so much great information and networking opportunities that are second to none. I talk all the time about the networking that a lot of times, especially that maybe the newer generation, the younger generation, they think they can learn everything online, which is true. You can learn a lot. There's a lot of great information. And heck, the National Volunteer Fire Council Training Summit's going to be virtual this year. That is phenomenal. But nothing beats face-to-face interaction and networking with those who are presenting the classes and your fellow firefighters from all over the United States and beyond to learn, hey, how do you do things? What challenges do you face? What other things are you doing in your area to be more professional? So give it a look. Check it out, nationalvolunteerfirecouncil.org or nvfc.org, and check out that training summit. And again, you can sign up and do some of the virtual training at the end of the month. There'll be some great snippets of some of the shows and or presentations they offer, and I highly encourage it. I highly encourage it. So thanks to the National Volunteer Fire Council. Thanks to Fire Engineering. Thanks to Chief Bobby Halton and everyone else who supports these podcasts, these training seminars, these conferences, so we can all get the word out and talk about how great it is to be a firefighter. Thanks for listening in, and I hope things are going well in your department. I hope it's going well in your fire department family and in your own personal family. Certainly, it's been an extremely challenging few months, challenging to many on the personal side being affected by the coronavirus. Either they're getting ill or loved ones are getting ill. God forbid, suffering the death of a loved one or somebody they know. It's affecting so many people. Many people not working. They're unable to go out and about like normal. It's affected us in our firehouse, too. So many volunteer firehouses are off limits now. For emergency responses only can people go to the firehouse. And they're not even training in the firehouse, which to me is just crazy. But in true fire service spirit, in ingenuity, in learning to do things a different way, we're learning to train other ways, right? So many online presentations and seminars now that normally are held at some of the events that have been postponed or canceled, they're available online. Take advantage of those. Spend a few hours during the week to learn something new and educate yourself about our great fire service. My own department a couple weeks ago did a nice online Zoom training drill, covered some of our SOGs for hydrant hookups and getting water quickly on the fire. And again, nothing beats good hands-on training. Hopefully we'll be getting back to that soon enough. Nothing beats the networking opportunities that come by attending the seminars and meeting people face-to-face. But for now, this is certainly filling the void, and it's filling the void pretty well. There's so much out there. There's a lot that's available that you can take advantage of. Hey, and if you're an officer or someone in your department who's expected to help out with training drills, put on a presentation or consider putting together a presentation for your department or getting people access to some of this fantastic training available online. Maybe just put a link together and get it out to your people so they can access this online. Because fires and emergencies, they're not affected by the quarantine, right? And out the door, we still must go. And we still need to maintain our proficiency and skill sets and be ready and prepared for what awaits us. That's what professionals do, after all, isn't it? So the way to maintain that efficiency, the way to stay sharp and keep your own personal skills up to speed, the way to build camaraderie and develop a strong team concept is through a quality training program. A training program that becomes part of the department's culture. One of the biggest knocks against the volunteer fire service is that training is lacking and volunteers don't train enough, or they don't hold their members accountable to ensure they get enough drills in or enough of the right drills, and maybe volunteers only handpick the easy drills to go to, maybe the ones they're sitting in the classroom for only. Oftentimes in the volunteer agencies, the more time you have in, the fewer training drills you're required to go to. Sometimes we hear it from our own members. Our training drills are really not that good. What a waste of time that was. Time is a volunteer's most precious resource, people. And if we waste it, if they come home from work or come home from working at their house or doing things around the house and run off to the firehouse, and they come home and say that was a waste of time, they're not going to go next week or next month for that training drill. They're going to find something else to do. We need to put drills together that are well-structured and motivate our members to go. Heck, I remember leaving my daughter's baseball games to get to the training drill on time. I remember leaving other family functions because it was training night and I wanted to get to the firehouse. It, pardon the pun, it fired me up for the job. It got me excited. They were well put together, well structured. They accounted for everyone that was coming, whether they had a month in or 6 months in or 20 years in. And they accounted for good attendance, bad attendance, good weather, bad weather. It was organized and ready to go. And if it's not, people are going to find something else to do the next time the training night rolls around. Training is a big deal, and we struggle so often in the volunteer fire service in many areas related to training. We could spend an entire show, and we've talked about it in the past, talking about motivating members to go, getting veteran members to still train, including all the members of different ranks and tenures and experiences in training. We could talk about how to properly instruct, because in the volunteer fire company so often it's congratulations, brand new lieutenant, you're doing a drill next week. And they might not have any clue how to put that drill together or how to deliver it where it makes a difference and impacts those intending. And one thing that's truly unique with the volunteer fire service, in many cases we have new people joining at all different times, and it can be a struggle to properly acclimate these new members into the department, especially where training is concerned. It's not like a paid department with a big recruit class coming in and they can all be trained together. Now, some areas of the country may do that, and some departments I know only bring in new members once or twice a year to facilitate making training a little bit easier and getting everyone up to speed maybe a little bit quicker and at the same pace. But the point is, in the volunteer agencies, we have to figure out how to properly bring newer members in and train them, ensuring they get the attention they need, while remembering we have a whole other group, a whole other contingent of members who likewise need training. And most likely in the volunteer department, training is maybe once a week, some do it once a month or maybe on a weekend. But the point again is, we need to train a whole bunch of members at all different ages, all different tenures, all different experiences, all different experience levels, and it can be difficult. And we don't want to try and give them any reason to say, I'm not going to that drill or taking the time to that go to that drill because there's nothing in it for me. And recently I was reading through April's Fire Engineering magazine. And as I always do, I stop and check out the Volunteers Corner because, hey, it has good information for us in the Volunteer Fire Service. And I recommend you spend some time reading not only that great trade magazine, but so many of the others. But when you pick up Fire Engineering, check out the Volunteers Corner every month because, hey, there's a lot of good information. And shameless plug here, I will have an article in the July edition in the Volunteers Corner. But as a professional, we should be picking up these magazines and staying on top of what's going on in our fire service. So I encourage you to do that. So I'm doing it. I'm reading through April's magazine, and boom, there's an article that popped right out at me that had to do with exactly what we're talking about here tonight. Three options for training rookie volunteer members. An article by Robert Callahan, and I am so pleased to have him on the show this evening to discuss this article because it is such an important topic and, quite frankly, an area where many training officers struggle. And I'd also like to talk to him and use his experiences and expertise about the larger topic of training drills in general and how to confront some of the challenges I just talked about. Now, he's been in the fire service for almost 40 years. He's currently the fire prevention officer and a captain down in the Louisiana Fire District Number 1. I believe it's called Bossier, B-O-S-S-I-E-R. I'm going to ask him that. I'm embarrassed I didn't do it ahead of time. But he's down in Louisiana, and he has served as an assistant chief and an adjunct instructor with the Louisiana State University Fire Training Institute. He's been a contract instructor at the National Fire Academy. He's a district representative for the Firefighter Cancer Support Network. He's been a longtime instructor. He's a fellow FDIC instructor as well. So he's certainly well-versed in the fire service and the volunteer fire service. So please, let me welcome aboard Robert Callahan. Robert, are you with me?
I sure am. Thank you for having me on, Tom.
So honored to have you on with us tonight. How's things going down in Louisiana? I am supposed to be going down there for a conference in mid-July, and I was told last week the conference is still on, which kind of shocked me. And now my family's giving me grief about jumping on an airplane and flying down there. So tell me, how's things going down in Louisiana?
Things are going pretty well. From the coronavirus standpoint, New Orleans has really been a hot spot, and there's been a few minor hot spots in other parts throughout the state, but by and large, outside of New Orleans, things that haven't been very bad at all. It's had some impact, but the impact has really not been as significant as they expected. It's nice. Weather's nice. I'm about ready to pick peppers out of my garden, and I got lettuce, and my tomatoes aren't too far behind. Probably another 2 or 3 weeks, I'll have a whole bunch of tomatoes, so things are going well down here.
Well, excellent. As luck would have it, I think my conference that I'm going to is about a half hour to an hour outside of New Orleans, and I believe the airport of choice I'll be landing in is New Orleans, so yikes. But
it's better now. The numbers are way down. Last number I saw was there's only about 850 people statewide that are in the hospital right now for coronavirus.
Okay.
So it's
not
really significant. Yeah, it'll be down even further. So you'll be good.
And greetings from the great state of New York and the Buffalo region, where today it reached 92 degrees and still, I think, 90 right now or 88. And spent a day working in the yard, floating in my pool, grilling some chicken, maybe had a beer or two. And, wow, we are enjoying this for May 26th, that's for sure. And I know when people think of Buffalo, they think of snow and cold and freezing rain, and I've been the first to admit we get that, and I've talked on my shows when it's been happening on show night, but today, hey, 92 degrees, beautiful here in Western New York, and we're getting summer fever, that's for sure. So, Bob, thanks for being on the show tonight, and correct me on the how do I pronounce the fire company here? Is it Bossier?
Nope, it's Bossier.
Bossier,
almost
okay.
Like Z's instead of X's. I mean, instead of S's, Bossier. It's a combination department. We have 11 paid people, about 45 to 55 volunteers. I'm also a training officer for a couple of smaller rural fire departments in Webster Parish, all volunteer. And then I work part-time for another combination department. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about your background and what brought you into the fire service, and maybe give us a little bit of your journey and how you ended up where you are.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York. I grew up in Albany, actually, so I know Buffalo pretty well. But I lived on a fairly busy street in Albany, and fire trucks would be going up and down the street on a pretty regular basis, so that I developed an interest in the fire service early. I went to college in northern Vermont, and they had a student-run fire department and rescue squad. At that time, there were 4 student-run fire departments in Vermont. Now there's only one, unfortunately, but they had a student-run fire department. I became involved with that. Worked my way up to training officer. In my final year, I was chief. I graduated from college, moved around a little bit, was sort of a nomad in the fire service, was on several small volunteer suburban departments as I moved around. I finally settled down in northern Vermont in 1987 and became involved with the suburban department in Colchester, Vermont, a fairly busy suburban department. And became an instructor there, became part of the training committee, started teaching at regional schools, doing some work for some other fire departments that needed some training. And then I moved to Louisiana in 2002 and just sort of continued where I was going. And as you said, currently I work for LSU Fire Training as an adjunct. I work for the National Fire Academy. District rep for Louisiana Arson and Fire Prevention, district rep for Firefighters Cancer Support Network, and basically my wife doesn't see me a whole lot because most nights I'm out and about doing something somewhere.
Spoken like a true volunteer, that's for sure. So I didn't realize you were from the New York area. Boy, another one of our transplants. Wow. We always say the greatest export in New York State is our people.
Oh, I agree
sure.
with that. I'm trying to convince the Southerner to that.
So true, so true. So your article intrigued me. It jumped right out at me because training is such a huge topic in the fire service, and it's easy for me to get people to talk about training, but it's not always easy to get people to attend training. And it's just such a difficult topic on so many levels. But your article, you know, how to bring rookies or newer members up to speed and consider different ideas for training them really, really jumped out at me. And I'd like to jump into the meat and potatoes of that article. And again, for our listeners, that was in the April edition of Fire Engineering, and I encourage you to check it out. It was just filled with some great information. But, you know, it starts off by, you know, addressing the fact that the most daunting challenge is how to effectively train new volunteer members, because you have to balance the initial training needs that they have against the time that's available. And again, you hear it all the time. What is one of the most precious commodities a volunteer has? It's time. And there's a lot of demands on the volunteers, not just going to calls, but doing house duties or maybe even fundraising, or just you could think of anything else going on at the local volunteer firehouse. So you've got to balance all this together. So some companies decide, hey, we can let the rookie ride out right away and kind of get on the job training. Right. That's happened to me. They threw boots and helmet at me.
Oh, it's happened to me. I can tell you that probably that's how I was trained. And that's, whenever I went to a new fire department, and I've been on about 11 fire departments in my career, some simultaneously, but pretty much that was the way it was done. Here are the keys to the fire station. In fact, I can remember one fire department. I was the only one that responded to a particular fire station just based on where I lived, and I had just moved into that community a week before that, and all of a sudden, I'm the only one going to that station, the only one that going to be first due in that area, and I got a truck that I'm not overly familiar with in a district that I really don't know very well, very rural, and it was a challenge. And, you know, and there's still fire departments that train that way, that train their new members that way, and that just doesn't work out particularly well, especially if you want to appear professional to your community, to have folks jumping off the apparatus and just not having a clue what they're supposed to do. That's a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you talk in the article about how to put together these, you know, or consider the three different ideas that you talk about in the article. But before even considering the ideas, you discuss the point about, hey, before you decide on what program you're going to implement, ask the questions about what do you want the training to achieve. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, just like any training program, you have to know where you're going. So you want to have some objectives. What do you expect these guys to be able to do when they're done with their rookie training? Do you expect them to have all the skills that they're going to need? Or do you expect to have them have particular skills? Okay, how much supervision is there on the department? If you're letting guys conduct some pretty significant operations with little experience, with very little supervision, that represents a problem. Okay, and how well do you expect them to do it? So you have to ask those three questions. You have to determine where you want your training program to go. If you don't have a set of expectations, you can tell your guys, for example, I want you to be able to get this hose line off on the ground in service and at the door in 2 minutes. They're not going to know what to expect. They're not going to know if, well, I did it in 3 minutes. Is that okay? So you need to give them a very clear set of expectations. And you have to give your officers a very clear set of directions as to how well you want them supervised. If you don't do that, they're going to be lost on the fire ground.
And you know what, Bob? You know what that means? You got to sit down ahead of time and actually think about these things. You got to put some time in and think about your training program and answer these questions about what do you want to accomplish and what time frame do you want to accomplish it and what your level of participation are your officers going to play. It takes a little bit of time. And yes, here's that word again, volunteer. Well, we're just volunteers. Well, again, the premise of the show, and I think you fully support it, is you're a professional. Doesn't matter that you're a volunteer, you're still a professional. And you've got to treat this task, preparing drills and putting together a good training program, seriously, and put the time in to think about how to structure it and accomplish what you want to accomplish, and not just come to the firehouse on Tuesday night and say, what do you want to do tonight?
Yeah, I mean, expecting to be able to run a solid training program without significant amount of planning is basically just a wish. There's no other way to describe it. If you expect that you can show up 15 minutes before the drill, have a quick conversation with the guys doing the training, saying this is what I want to do, and expect that this drill is going to go well or that it's going to achieve your objectives, assuming you've even sat down and then decided what your objectives were, it's just a wish. That's all that it is. So more important aspect of delivering training is the planning aspect. Yeah, maybe you got some guys out there that have done this a while and can put that drill together in 15 minutes. But the reality is most people aren't going to be able to do that and have the drill come off the way they want it to. And that's especially true if you're talking about training for new volunteers, because this has to be a progression. Okay? If you don't take this and plan the progression in very slow steps and you skip a step or two, you're going to lose them. So
yeah, let's talk.
There has
let's
to
talk.
Be a planning sequence for this.
Yeah, we'll talk. Let's talk about that for a second, because I can only talk about my experience. And my experience is you get a new member. And we, in my department, we take them in 12 months a year. You know, whenever they join and go through the process, boom, you're accepted. We don't do it in stages like some companies do. And I could see advantages to both ways. But boom, we take a new member in, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, start going to drill Wednesday night. And whatever drill happens to be, whether it's advanced auto extrication, advanced fire attack, or maybe it is a basic ground ladder drill, doesn't matter. That rookie's just thrown into the mix. So your article gives three different ideas for bringing these rookies in. And let's consider the three ideas that you talk about, because you do have to give some time and thought to not just the training program, but bringing in rookie new members. So if you want to mind, let's start with your option number one.
Okay.
You don't
want to participate. Option number one is a full-blown Firefighter 1 class. In some states, that's your only option. There are states out there, and I'm not really sure what ones there are. I know Florida is certainly one of them, but there are states that require that anybody performing the duty of a firefighter has to be Firefighter 1. So in those states, you really don't have an option. Most of them actually do mandate volunteers be Firefighter 1 as well. So you really don't have a choice. Now, obviously, the advantage to Firefighter 1 is you are going to get a member that is very well trained, very comprehensive training. They're going to have everything they need, most everything they need in terms of basic information for basic firefighting operations, water supply, vehicle extrication. Certainly not going to knock Firefighter 1, but you are looking at, by the time you're done with all the prerequisites in the course itself, you're looking at 150, 160, 170 hours. For a volunteer that's working 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day, now you're expecting them to go to class two nights a week, three nights a week. It's a pretty significant burden. There are some that might be able to do it, but for the most part, it's going to be a very significant burden. It's going to set them up.
Yeah, they may also be going to school. Yeah,
exactly.
If you get the younger volunteer, now he's balancing it with his school load, too.
Exactly. So
a part-time job.
Yep. So it's an option, but is it the best option? Is it the best use of time? I would argue that in some cases it's not going to be, especially a smaller department, rural department, that has a limited number of exposures, limited number of occupancies. may do a limited number of firefighting evolutions. They may not do vehicle rescue. They may not do hazmat. They may not have much beyond the Dollar General or the corner store. Do they really need the skills involved moving a hose line up to the third floor of a building? So certainly I'm not going to knock having that skill, but I think one of the issues with Firefighter 1 would be on the time is to some degree the relevance in communities that may have a very limited number of skills. And that comes down to doing a skills inventory on what your members actually do. That can actually be one of the first steps in your planning process is sitting down with your officers and saying, what exactly do our members do? Very basic, okay? How often do we pull X amount of hose? What forcible entry skills do we need? What ventilation skills do we need? And designing your program, especially when we get into the other two options, designing your program around your skills inventory. And that, I think, is a really important step for every fire department.
Yeah, you don't want to just haphazardly. Here we go again. You don't want to throw it half together haphazardly. And again, just like we said, it requires thinking and the thought process ahead of time and putting some effort into analyzing where you're at and where you want to be.
Yep, and it's all about relevance. Adult learners are not going to take an active part in learning unless they see the relevance in what you're trying to teach them. So if you're a small community with single-story homes, such as here in Louisiana, most of the homes in Louisiana are single-story. Not like it was where I grew up in Albany, where the majority of the homes were two-story homes. So for us, the skill of advancing hose line up the stairwell to the second floor is not a particularly relevant skill. Now, we do teach it. We do teach it later on as an advanced skill. But for 90% of our homes, it's not a skill that's relevant. So that's what I mean when I say developing that skill inventory. Look at your building and see how buildings and see how you actually have to advance hose. See how you have to actually perform forcible entry on the doors you're going to find in your district. Or the water supply situation you're going to find in your district. Have to make it relevant and applicable to what you do every day, or else you're wasting time, and you may lose the interest of the personnel that you're trying to train.
Now, in your experience, when people do this type of training where they mandate Firefighter 1 certification, in some cases Firefighter 1 and 2, are the volunteers able to participate in department functions, activities, and even go to calls, or are they kind of not able to participate at all, or have you seen it done both ways?
I've seen it done both ways. My current combination department, we allow them to participate. We actually have a very high rate of volunteer members in my combination department that have achieved Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2. We also have a lot of them that have used that to move on to career positions. My full-time department is, we have some pretty significant people in the Bossier City and Shreveport Fire Department that started out with as volunteers. In fact, a lot of them actually started out as junior members with our department that have risen to the upper levels of management in both Bossier City and Shreveport. So we've been very, very successful with sending our personnel to Firefighter 1. We do Firefighter 1 classes. But we also have a fairly large department where we have instructors and classrooms and props that we can do that. For a smaller department of 15 people, 20 people, without props, without a number of instructors, Firefighter 1 is going to be a challenge. It's going to be a whole lot of work that maybe they're really not ready for.
Are they riding the trucks, too? I know they're participating. Are they riding trucks and allowed to go to calls and at least stand by and watch? Or
yes, again, they are. We use a skill checklist where when they demonstrate that they can perform a skill, we check it off. So they're gradually becoming more and more involved in the operation. As they get more skills checked off, they're put in position where they're allowed to do more and more in terms of active firefighting. So generally speaking, by the time they're done – with Firefighter 1, even if they don't take Firefighter 1, by the time they're done with that skills checklist, they're fully prepared to be involved in active interior firefighting operations. So it does work fairly well for us.
I like what you said, too, about the junior programs. A shameless plug there for the success of the junior programs, which we've talked about on this show in the past. But again, you can't overemphasize how important they are for the long-term success of the volunteer fire service.
Currently in my full-time department, our chief, our assistant chief, and two of our captains came out of our junior program.
There it says it all right there. Cannot overemphasize the importance of junior programs. And another thing I found interesting in your article, toward the end of your discussion on this option number one, which is requiring Firefighter 1 certification, is, hey, even if you don't do that for your new recruit, consider that for a minimum standard for someone that wants to promote into the officer ranks. I thought that was a great idea.
Oh, definitely. We have that requirement, again, in my combination department. We have it here in one of my volunteer departments. I think it's important because it shows the leadership that person is committed to the organization. And that's what you need from your officers. You don't want to bring somebody up, put them in a position of an officer's position, and not have them committed to what they have to do. So not only from a knowledge standpoint, I think, is that important, especially if you're running mutual aid into areas that maybe you're going to find occupancies that you don't necessarily have in your home district. But it also just shows that they're committed to the fire service. They understand the importance of training. They understand the importance of education. And hopefully they'll pass that on to the other individuals that may not have Firefighter 1. You got to set the leadership has to set the pace, to set the tone for the organization. And if they don't, if there's no leadership, no pace, no tone, the organization's going to wander around like a chicken.
You're going to be in trouble. So option one, Firefighter 1 certification, or in some cases, Firefighter 1 and 2. Obviously, you're going to get a member, a volunteer member, who is really good as far as being trained and up to speed and capable of stepping into a wide range of situations. The time commitment is going to be excessive and considerable, and some obviously are going to say, I can't do this because of the time constraints, but it gets you a well-rounded, well-trained firefighter. Not probably the best option for everybody, so you discuss another idea, which is the mini school. You want to talk a little bit about your experiences with that?
Yep, that's my basic experience with that was in Colchester. When I first came into the Colchester Center Volunteer Fire Company, we had about a 25-hour orientation program. We used that for a couple of years, and then we started to transition. Colchester started to move from a bedroom community, a rural community, a community with a lot of camps. We started to see some suburban development. We started to see some 3- and 4-story hotels. We started to see some 3- and 4-story office buildings, some very big retail facilities. And the decision was made by the leadership that we had something good, but it just wasn't adequate anymore for what we were going to be experiencing now that the community was changing. So we took that 20-hour course, and we basically expanded it out to about 60 hours. Combination of classroom and field, and it was primarily focused on the basics of residential firefighting, PPE, SCBA, residential forcible entry, water supply, which was for us both hydrant and rural water. We had to train on both. We trained on basic residential fire attack, single-story, two-story, and then after that we would use department drills to move them into more advanced skills, commercial fire alarm operations, that kind of thing. But it was a fairly good course. Within a year or two, we actually recruited another fire department that became involved with it, that we ran mutual aid with quite a bit. And soon after that, another fire department became involved in the school. So we had three fire departments. We'd run it probably about 3 to 4 times a year. Each department would provide instructors. We'd rotate the facilities, rotate the classrooms among the three fire departments. And the real strong advantage was that new guys got to know the other new guys on the other two fire departments we ran mutual aid with.
That's fantastic.
Developed some camaraderie, and there were familiar faces when they showed up at a fire. And I think that's really important.
I can see a major advantage of this, but I wonder if there were any hiccups along the way. In my experience, and tell me if you agree with this or not, but in my experience, and I talk about this in my presentation of Professional Volunteer Fire Department, some of the source of dysfunction, and when I use the word dysfunction, that's what people see that maybe contributes to anything but a professional reputation, but it comes from possibly not just your own members doing tasks differently, because I learned this way, this firefighter learned another way. We have a new chief today who wants it done this way, but not the way you were taught 5 years ago. That can lead to a lot of dysfunction, which looks unprofessional. But now you can also have that in the larger scale when you have mutual aid departments coming in and they do things in a different manner. And now you're raising a ladder one way, but I'm thinking we're doing it another way and we're tripping over each other. But if we have these rookie classes where we have people from neighboring departments training together, they're learning, hopefully, to do things in a similar fashion. But is getting people to agree, is getting the leaders to agree on a set training curriculum, have you seen that? Is that difficult?
That was a challenge. We did operate pretty closely in terms of procedures. But there were some issues regarding, you know, how do you wrap the hydrant? One department wrapped the hydrant, one department didn't wrap the hydrant. Doesn't seem like a big deal, but again, gets back to that planning element, working that out beforehand. So basically what we did, we essentially took the Firefighter One book, we looked at it, we evaluated whether we were doing it the way that the book said, and we compromised, and basically the skills were taught according to the edition of the book that we were using. And I'm not going to say that happened overnight, but within one or two sessions of the class or one or two deliveries of the class, most of those problems were worked out pretty easily.
And now you got people operating on the same page, which is...
Exactly.
The way you want
exactly.
it to be. And you're going to be calling these people for help at structure fires and large incidents, so why not have everyone on the same page?
Yeah, we were actually using them for everything. We had mutual aid for just about any run, vehicle fires, brush fires. So we were seeing them on a pretty regular basis. And then fire alarms, we get all three departments. So we were working together probably at least once every couple of days. So it's a fairly frequent event when we'd work together with them.
Now, when they're doing this 60 or 65-hour rookie class, are they also attending maybe? Because Firefighter One's only come around so often, and sometimes they fill up quickly. So is it a challenge? Do you sometimes have members doing both? I'm in a 65-hour rookie class, but now on Tuesdays and Thursday evenings, I have to go to Firefighter One, or do you kind of encourage people to do one or the other?
Well, interestingly enough, my son finally got involved in the fire service about 2 years ago with the sister department that I was on in Colchester, and they gave him the option. They were doing the class, which actually the 60-hour class has now been adopted by the entire county. Which is pretty cool. But they gave him the option of taking the 60-hour class or taking Firefighter One that was being done at the same time. And he chose Firefighter One because he's thinking long-term. He's thinking possibly a full-time career in the fire service. So he chose the Firefighter One option. But they did give him the option of one or the other.
So can they skip Firefighter One permanently? If they choose the rookie, the 65-hour class, do they not have to take Firefighter One?
Well, I'm not in that area anymore, but from what I understand, Firefighter One is strongly encouraged after you take the 60-hour class. Because the 60-hour class is pretty particular to that area. Firefighter One is going to give them a lot of general knowledge, and I think those departments do like to see their members that want to advance to take Firefighter One down the road.
I gotcha. You know, you mentioned something interesting, too, that I want to just get your opinion on or input on, because it's not really thought of as a drill topic, but I think it really needs to be, because I think we go to more types of calls like this than just about anything else. You quickly covered. One of the topics is the fire alarm investigating and teaching some skills that need to be understood by the rookie, and I think it's probably important that we do that for senior members as well. Tell me a little bit about that drill station or evolution. What are you covering there?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to make sure that the senior members understand that a fire alarm is a fire or a potential fire. I think you've probably seen it. I know I've seen it all over the country where the fire department shows up to a fire alarm and the three guys or four guys get off the truck and they have their station uniforms on because they've been here 10 times in the last 6 months. That's a challenge. That's a challenge to get a lot of times your senior members to acknowledge the fact that they're potentially going to a fire. Now, 95% of the time, they're not. So human nature is going to kick in and say, let's take the easy route. We've never had a fire here. It's always been an alarm. So throw on your bunker pants maybe, and if we see something when we get there, we'll throw the coat on and the air pack on. So the first step is just simply dealing with your existing members that a fire alarm is to be treated like a fire. And then you just work the rookies on the same plane. You explain to them how a fire alarm system works. You explain how some of the reasons you get a false alarm on a fire alarm. You explain how you may not see anything at all from the outside of the building, and then you get up that elevator or climb up that stairwell to the third floor, and all of a sudden you got smoke. And if you don't have a tick, if you don't have a extinguisher, if you don't have an iron set, you're not going to be able to do your job. So it just comes down to reinforcing with them how important it is to be prepared, which goes back to the premise of your show. Professional firefighters don't show up at a fire without the equipment to put out the fire.
Absolutely.
And if we don't, during the rookie process, let them know you need everything that you would normally bring to a fire when you get off that elevator or step out of that stairwell, right? When you have an alarm, if you don't have it, you're not going to be very effective.
Oh, so true. You know, and you're right. You're a professional volunteer, and professional means being prepared. And then senior members listening to the show, we, because I'm a senior member with 38 years now, I don't know where the time's gone, but I lead by example. When you get on that rig, expect to see fire and be dressed and prepared and ready to go always. So
exactly. What is it, Andy Fredericks that said that garbage men don't get excited when they turn the corner and see garbage?
Mm-hmm. Right.
As firefighters, we shouldn't be excited when we turn the corner and see fire.
It's
what we should expect to see, and we should be ready for it.
Yep. So we set the tone right away as a senior member or a leader in our department by being dressed and prepared and ready to go and expecting to see fire. And it's funny because I've seen so many alarm investigation calls where we've got members wandering the building, and maybe they know they're looking for an activated head. But in a lot of cases, they go in and someone might find the head and relay it to the incident commander, and he resets the alarm. And before you know it, everyone's back on the rig and back to the firehouse and back on their way home or to work or whatever they're doing. But they really had no clue as to what they were looking for or what they were supposed to do. So I got to think that's a pretty important topic that you guys are covering by doing this alarm investigation drill station.
Well, when I was back there, again, it's been 20 years since I've been there, but alarms are half of what we did. We would go to hotels on a regular basis. We had a college campus that we would go to on a very regular basis. We had some warehouses that we would go to on a regular basis. So basically, we were a fire company. We were a false alarm company that occasionally went to a fire. would be the best way to describe
it. There's a lot of fire companies like that.
We had a lot of practice dealing with alarm trips.
Right, right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of companies like that. So with the rookie class, with the 60-hour, 65-hour class, who's teaching it? Is it officers in the various fire companies? Is it senior members? Is it state instructors? Or
It could be anything. In Colchester, we use the officers and the instructors from the three fire departments. At the beginning of the class, we would find out what officers, what instructors were interested, and they all had their particular strong points. We had officers that liked to teach the same thing over and over. You know, maybe we had an officer that was really strong in forcible entry. He would want to teach that. We had another officer that was strong in fire behavior. He would teach that. So we would use the skills of the three departments. We would use the experience and the knowledge of the officers, the instructors on all three departments. And generally speaking, it was the same folks over and over that would teach what they liked. But we did try to incorporate new people in because that's one of the things in the volunteer fire service that we sometimes don't do very well is think about training the up-and-coming folks to replace the folks that may retire someday, or may move, or may just have to leave the fire department for some reason. So not only for us was it a process to train the rookies, but just as importantly, it was an ongoing process which gave us the ability to train new instructors, folks that maybe hadn't instructed before. It was a good way to bring them up. They'd teach under the supervision of an experienced person, and within a couple of rotations, we now had instructors that were capable of stepping in if the older members couldn't teach that particular program.
So often not thought about the importance of succession management and remembering that we got to bring those people up that are coming up behind us and pass on our lessons learned and take some time with them, because so often, and again, in the volunteers, it's okay, you're now a new officer, you got to teach drill next week, and there's no foresight into teaching them what it means to teach a drill.
No, it's very difficult. Obviously, if they have the resources to go to instructor one, that gives them some background, but you know, sitting in an instructor one class and listening for 40 hours and then doing that one or two presentations you have to do for 15 minutes in class is a whole different world than now having to stand in front of two or three fire departments and do a two-hour drill. It's some preparation, but it's a learning curve. I hate to say it, but it's an on-the-job learning curve.
Sure. Sure. Someone dinging in here with a question that they want me to ask you with the rookie program of 65 hours. Are they, in your area anyway, were they allowed to then, they're allowed to go in and into a structural firefighting environment? And if something was to happen, God forbid, where they get hurt, there's no harm in them not having the full Firefighter One certification. In other words, there's someone signing off on that 65 hours of training saying that they're okay to go in structural firefighting environments.
Yes. They had to pass a written test. Basically, it was we would take the relevant questions from Firefighter One, so they had to pass a written test. And then at the end, they had to pass a manipulative test where they could demonstrate the skills to us.
Okay.
Generally speaking, during that class, they did not make structural entry. We would allow them to, once the fire was knocked down and if they had completed the SCBA sections and the overhaul sections, we would allow them inside to assist with overhaul operations under supervision. But they generally were not allowed to make entry as a fire attack team until they completed the class.
Gotcha. And we talked about the challenges of coming up with maybe a, especially if we're doing this class for other departments around us, coming up with some uniform procedures and ways of operating to get everybody on the same page. Any other challenges associated with the rookie class that you want to talk about?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest one. The other challenge is, you know, we did try to do it 3 to 4 times a year, so we were starting a class roughly every 3 to 4 months, but there were situations where people applied and maybe they didn't want to wait 3 months and we lost them. And that is a challenge. But I guess our philosophy was if they couldn't wait 2 months or 3 months, we really wondered how interested they were to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the other biggest challenge, other than the coordination between multiple departments if you're going to do a multi-department type class.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like an interesting concept, and it sounds like you've experienced a lot of success with that type of rookie training program.
We as I said, it's now been expanded countywide. So I think a lot of departments in the county saw the value in it, and it was a good compromise. It gave us people that understood the basics of firefighting, residential firefighting, understood the basics of assisting in performing a search in a fire alarm situation without overwhelming them. And then after they completed that, they would start attending drill, and then they'd start learning some additional skills. So for us, it worked out very well.
And for your average volunteer that maybe isn't worried about the state or national certification or going on to be a career firefighter, they own their own business, they're in a career they're completely happy with, but they want to serve their community and be a member of their local volunteer fire department and perform as a professional, this class has filled the void.
Yep. Yeah, I really think it does. I think it's an excellent option for a lot of departments. For some departments, maybe it's not even 60 hours. You have a small rural department that has a very limited number of building types, single-family homes, maybe 4 or 5 commercial buildings in their center of town, may have some farm buildings. They don't have to worry about hydrants. They run completely on tanker water supply operations. Maybe they can do the skills that they need in 40 hours. So it doesn't even need to be 60. Again, we go back to the skill inventory, taking a look mm-hmm. at what your members do and how often they do it, and developing your training around that skill inventory.
And tailor it, yeah, for your area. What are you going to be expect? What are you going to see, and what are you going to be expected to do?
Exactly. What do you expect your members to do? How under what level of supervision you expect them to do it? And how quickly do you expect them to do it? Ask those 3 questions, you'll come up with your objectives for your training program.
Excellent. So that's option 2, called the mini school. And again, it takes some time. It's not going to be completed overnight. It takes cooperation of the leadership from all agencies. Maybe it's just one department doing it, but if you expand it to other departments, people got to sit down and work together and put together a model that's going to work for their area and base the skills on the local experiences there and maybe the local construction and occupancies that you face out there. So great idea. A lot of good information there. And then in the article, you talk about the third option, which is called train as you go. And I would say, yes, this is definitely the most common way that most volunteer members are indoctrinated into the fire service or even the combination service. And, you know, that involves new members just being trained alongside our existing members at the department's weekly training drill or monthly training drill. But in your opinion, it's the least effective method, isn't it?
Yeah. Because based on a couple of reasons. First of all, you don't have the ability to sequence your drills. Obviously, we want to talk to members about fire behavior, as an example, before we talk to them about fire attack. We want to talk to them about building construction before we talk to them about fire attack. Train as you go is dependent on the department training schedule. So that person showing up for the drill the first night may show up for a drill on vehicle extrication or may show up for a drill on rapid intervention. They really don't have any kind of prior knowledge, prior experience. as to what they're seeing. So it doesn't give you the ability to say, okay, we're going to start off week one with fire service history. Week two, district orientation. Week three and week four, PPE. Week five, building construction. Week six, fire behavior, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're learning things out of sequence. They're learning things hodgepodge, which for some people may work, but for a lot of people it's going to cause a whole lot of confusion in their mind. So that's probably the biggest problem. The other problem is, how do you tailor a drill for somebody with no experience and somebody with 20 years of experience in the same drill? That's a problem. Obviously, if you have enough instructors, you can break them up into multiple groups, but that requires multiple instructors. And for a lot of departments, that's simply not an option.
Takes a lot of planning, too. And again, we talked earlier in the show about a lot of people don't put the time and effort into properly planning the drill.
Yep. That's probably, as I said, the least effective method, simply because you don't have control over the sequence. And you don't have as much control over what they're experiencing. If they've never been in PPE, and you say, put this coat and this pants and this air pack on, and you're just going to go in and watch the smoke, first of all, they're not going to be very comfortable. Second of all, if you haven't given them some classroom training on what they're looking for in the smoke or what they're looking for in the fire behavior, they're going to pick up very little from that observation. So it really is not a particularly effective way. Now, there are ways to make it more effective. One of the ways I talked about earlier was the checklist. We have a combination department. We have a skills checklist. That's about 3 pages long. It's primarily Firefighter 1 skills with some Firefighter 2 skills. As they are able to demonstrate those skills to an officer or a senior member, the skills get checked off. So we do have some way of saying, okay, you've demonstrated the ability to do this. And after they complete the entire checklist and they pass a written test and they complete a computer-based Firefighter 1 class on the computer, they now come off probation. So we've coupled some other things along with the train-as-you-go method to make it a little more effective.
Yeah, because I'd say it probably, as you mentioned in the article, is probably one of the most common ways that it's being done. So we've got to make it as effective as possible. So there's some good ideas there on how to make it maybe just a little bit more effective. And I know you can try and break the drill up into senior members, rookie members, and that, but it just takes time and effort and a lot of coordination and communication among the parties that are running the drill ahead of time. And again, with everyone's time being so limited today, it doesn't always come out as easy as it would seem. It just doesn't come out. It's a little dysfunctional and unorganized, and people go home and maybe are like, I didn't learn much tonight. And that's the last thing we want.
If we're not using their time wisely, they're going to find somewhere else to spend their time. That it doesn't matter if you're talking about bowling or firefighting. Now, obviously, firefighting is a little more critical. If they're coming to training and not expecting to walk away with a lot of knowledge, or at least enough knowledge to make it worth their time, they may not show up at training. And then that creates problems on the fire ground. New piece of equipment, they haven't had their hands on it. Now, you got a problem.
Oh, yeah. If our members are taking the time to attend drill, our leaders need to make sure that they're taking the time to organize the drill.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that drill now. So you've covered 3 different drill ideas for the rookie. Your idea, in your opinion, obviously the most successful is the rookie school, the mini school. Well, let's take drills and training overall, because, again, in the volunteer fire service, it's a huge topic. And there's a lot of departments out there doing some really good things, and there's a lot of departments out there struggling to get anybody showing up other than those teaching the drill. I've heard I get comments and emails from all over the country, and unfortunately I've had trainers show up at their firehouse on training night, and other than those two or three officers putting on the drill, there's nobody else showing up. What, in your opinion, is one of the biggest obstacles that needs to be overcome in the volunteer firehouse to get people to attend training?
Apathy. Leadership. If you don't have leaders that are setting the pace, setting the standards, letting everybody know what the standards are and enforcing the standards, you're going to have folks that may not show up. Now, the flip side to that is obviously what happens when they don't show up. I have a 15-member volunteer fire department in a small rural community, as an example, in one of my departments. At what point, as a leader, as a department leader, are we prepared to say, you're not showing up to training, we're cutting you loose? Now I have a 14-member department, or maybe there's three or four not showing up. Now I have a 10 or 11-member department. So it's easy to say they don't show up, you let them go. Maybe that's great if I got a 60-member department. I know you've been probably to the National Fire Academy, and you walk in the Emmitsburg Fire Station, and the entire wall on both sides of the bay is covered with turnout gear. Okay, if I got 100 members and I lose five, not a big deal. If
right.
I have 15 members and I lose two because they're not showing up for training, now that's a bigger deal. So
mm-hmm.
it becomes a tightrope as to how far you can let somebody go in terms of missing training before it becomes something you have to deal with.
Yeah, it's got to be part of the culture. Nick, it's a double-edged sword there. How do you make it become part of the culture? And I've actually heard those stories, as you probably have as well, where a new leadership team gets in place and they want to maybe have stricter training requirements, but they're met with so much rebuttal from the membership. And if they try to have rules and say, if you don't meet these minimum requirements, we're going to suspend or dismiss you, they wouldn't have a department left.
Mm-hmm. Now, we did, one department I was on, we did have that happen. We had about 50 members, about 20 were showing up for training. The fire chief said, this is the way it's going to be. You're going to make X percentage. I believe it was 75% of the training. We lost 20 members, and we actually had a better organization afterwards because we had everybody showing up for training. Everybody knew their job. We didn't have to worry about sending somebody for equipment and having them look in every compartment of the truck to find it, or not knowing how to start the saw, or not knowing how to stretch the hose, or whatever it might be. So there are some cases, at least that case in my experience, where setting standards and cleaning house actually improved the fire department. Not necessarily going to be the case all the time, but in that case, it did improve the fire department significantly.
Yeah. Yeah, tough love. Tough love. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, when you talk about leaders setting the example, I read through that too to not just our officers and chiefs, but your senior members. You're a new
yep.
member, and you see senior members dismissing drills, and you don't see them on the training ground. How quickly do you understand that, oh, it's okay if I don't go to that drill then?
Well, very quickly, because the fact is a lot of your senior members are your informal leaders. I know we're not FDNY by any stretch, but if you look at FDNY, the real leadership on the companies very often is that senior man. It's not the officer. The officer will tell the senior man what he wants done, and the senior man is the one that very often runs a big component of that firehouse. The culture has said the senior men are the leaders, and if you want to be a senior man, this is what's expected of you. We need to do the same thing in the volunteer fire service. We need to empower our senior members beyond the officers to be the leaders, to be the informal leaders, and they have more influence than most people imagine, in some cases more than the officers.
And, you know, one of the biggest obstacles, one of the biggest issues in the volunteer fire service and in a lot of organizations, and I've talked about it on the show in the past, is cliques and groups not accepting other groups and forming their own little in-house group in the firehouse, and you know, this group not participating or working with this other group. And I still say the best way to defeat that, the best way to have one click for one department, is to get people out on the training ground working together. And you can do it even if rookies are off on their own and senior members are off on their own, because ultimately you're still all up there working and training for a common cause, and maybe sharing a common meal at the end of the drill that night, or maybe before the drill that night. And boy, does that help build camaraderie and demonstrate teamwork and working together, and it knocks down cliques.
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt that a department that functions together beyond the fire ground is going to be a better department, whether it's something as simple as opening up the soda machine after the drill and letting everybody take a soda or two, whether it be something as simple as once a month you bring in pizza before the drill and everybody shows up, whether it be incorporating the families inside some type of family activity. The more you can bring these folks together in one way or another, the more you can bring them together, the stronger an organization you're going to have. And I've seen some very, very strong fire departments. And a lot of the reasons why they're strong is it's not just Joe on the fire department, but there's activities for Joe's wife, and there's activities for Joe's kids. And they get the families together, and everybody starts to know each other. And the cliques start to disappear. Not completely, especially in small towns. You're always going to have cliques, I think, in small town departments. But working together on the fire ground, but more importantly, doing stuff together once that drill is over, or maybe one Saturday a month, I think is really important in bringing everybody together.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, let's say you're the new training officer and you've really been working hard at trying to motivate members to attend. And, okay, you're doing good with the rookie members because they're new and that's what they expect to be doing. So they're coming around on training night. But let's say the message has been getting out to some of the senior members. I'm talking 30 years on, 25 years, 35 years, maybe even some past chiefs or past officers. If I'm a training officer, what can I be looking at to try and get them continued to be motivated to attend, and how can I involve them so they're not going home saying, well, I went to drill tonight, but it proved why I haven't been going. There was nothing for me to do, or they didn't, you know, give me the respect I think I earned. What can we do to take advantage of those senior members that are coming and encourage them to keep coming?
Well, the first thing is you need to involve them. I'm going to be honest. I have seen a lot of fire departments where the senior members, especially the older 20, 30-year members that can't fight fire anymore or don't want to fight fire anymore because of physical limitations, where they're sometimes just sort of shoved to the side. They're not involved, or they're not asked to be involved in the training process. They're not asked to be involved in designing drills. They're not asked to be involved to teach. So they don't feel like they're valued anymore and their experience isn't valued. We have to find a way on a personal relationship way to get them involved, to get them motivated to share that experience, share that knowledge. There may be some retraining involved. Because maybe they're not up to speed with the newer things because they haven't been involved. So, yeah, there might be some training involved to get them to understand this is why we do things now compared to the way we did it 20 years ago. But at the end of the day, if there's no effort to get them involved, if there's no effort to show them that they have value, there's no effort to show that their experience is considered important, they're going to drift away. They're not going to want to be involved. So we need to get them involved and keep them involved in the fire service.
Yeah, so important. Extend some professional courtesy their way in recognition of what they've given the department and contributed to the department over the years. And now, some people aren't comfortable maybe doing that, which is fine, but you give them the opportunity. And you don't put them on the spot, I've found, either. A lot of senior members sometimes they may get embarrassed because they're not as sharp as they used to be, and maybe they aren't up on that new tool that you mentioned that maybe the company just put in service. So you don't want to just spring it on them at the last minute. You want to talk to them ahead of time and say, hey, Jane, or hey, Joe, I'd like to use you at drill next week. I know you used to be really good with ropes and knots. Would you mind teaching a station? And sometimes they may say no, but they're certainly going to appreciate being asked.
Yeah, just being asked goes a long way.
Yeah, and
as you said, they may not feel comfortable. In fact, you walked up to them and asked them. That may be all it takes. And maybe they don't want to teach, but it might be all it takes to get them to come back to training next week because you showed them that you respect them, you showed them that you value their experience, and you showed them that you want them to still be a part of the department. And that's very important to an awful lot of folks.
Yeah, yeah. And asking their opinion maybe as to why you do something a certain way before you change it. Why do we do this type of hose load, or why did we ever buy this piece of equipment? I'm going to put it in the back room. Well, because here's the reason. At least we're extending
mm-hmm.
that courtesy and giving them a chance to explain why something's done a certain way. And boy, you can really improve morale that way.
Oh, you definitely can. And
yeah.
As you said, it's a team.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't want to fight fire anymore, but maybe just involving them in a drill, maybe that opens the door to talking to them about, you know, I want to start this new senior fall prevention program, or I want to start this new senior fire safety program. And I know that you're not as involved on the suppression side as you used to be, but we still value your experience. Would you be willing to be involved in this senior fall prevention program or whatever it might be? So maybe
mm-hmm.
even it doesn't involve them getting back or staying with the operation side, but maybe it opens some other doors to use them in some different ways.
So true. So I'm putting this training program together. I'm working with my rookies. I'm working with my senior members. Then the question always comes up is a couple things here. How often should we train? You know, a lot of departments only do once a month. Many do once a week, but some do once a month. And then what do we train on?
Well, that goes back to our skills inventory. We need to train, obviously, the most often on the skills we're going to use the most often. So if I don't, you know, we have to look at what we're going to do. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't train on new stuff. Maybe the last three or four times we trained on moving fire hose to a single-family dwelling, everybody did well. We met the objectives. We did it in a timely fashion. We had guys taking care of the kinks. We had guys working the corners. Now it's time to move up to maybe second story. We're going to advance hose up to the second story. We've mastered the first story. So a lot of it's going to depend on just simply how well they're able to master and perform those level one skills, if you want to call them that, the skills that you're going to use every day. Once you've mastered them, now we can think about, okay, we're going to go to the second floor. We're going to try commercial building forcible entry instead of residential building forcible entry. We're going to add a second fill site in our water supply, in our tanker shuttle drill. Not just have one fill site. We're going to add a second one because we're doing fine with the one drill site. So that's all going to be based on how well they're performing those basic skills. Once they demonstrate that ability, we can move them on to the next level. So how far as how often we train, I'm a firm believer in once a week. Anything less than that, to me, it is simply not adequate. You start throwing out holidays, and you might lose one or two drills a year to weather. You're now down to 55 drills, okay? 52 drills, 50 drills. Okay? Departments may have business meetings once a month. So now we take 12 drills away from there. Maybe they have a work night. So now we take 12 more drills away. There's no way you can be a professional fire department hands-on drilling 12 times a year or even 24 times a year. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's shared by a lot of people. I really do. And again, you think of, you know, our military, or you think of even professional sports teams, and they're pretty much training all the time, and that's what makes them professionals. And, you know, we want to wear the hats and the jackets and have the pins and the badges and put the sticker on the car. Well, it comes with a responsibility to train, to be proficient and prepared and ready to do the job, whatever the job is in your area that you are required to do.
Now, and I do understand that there's some departments out there that may say, okay, we simply don't have the time to do technical rescue, as an example, and that's fine. But the jobs that you select to do, make sure you know how to do them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And one last thing on training that I wanted to ask you, and is I'd like to get your input on officer participation. Again, I base a lot of what I talk about on my experiences. And in my experiences, we get our officers involved in planning drills and putting drills on. And at a drill night, if an officer isn't one of the teachers, in other words, was not involved in planning the drill or is not running a drill station, and I have seen it where officers kind of stand off in the distance because now I'm an officer, I don't have to do the drill station. My point to anyone listening tonight is if you're one of those officers, you are now a student and should just get in that drill station and participate like the other students because, hey, just wearing that officer's helmet doesn't make you as sharp and proficient as you need to be.
Oh, I fully agree with that. Now, I understand there's times when officers may have to deal with an issue, get together as a group. Preferably, that's not the time to do it, but there may be situations. But generally speaking, I believe that officers should be fully involved in drills as well. It shows that they're part of the team. And it shows that, quite honestly, shows the members that they know how to do the skill, which can be important.
And if they have a little humility, and as every leadership book talks about, ditch the ego a little bit, the team, your fellow members, are going to understand if the officer struggles a little bit and is very honest, saying, I need to be sharper like you do with this skill, so I'm working hard tonight to make myself better too. People appreciate that more so than just standing in the background saying, I don't have to do it because I'm an officer.
Yeah, and that creates, you talked about clicks, you talked about distancing. That certainly can create problems. It's not uncommon to hear sometimes the members grumble, well, how come I'm out here in my gear sweating and it's 95 degrees and those officers are standing over there in front of a fan and just chilling.
Right.
Okay. Again, we've now created something of a gap between the membership, line firefighters, and the officers. And down the line, that can create some pretty significant problems.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure. So a lot goes into the training. And I want to cycle back for a moment just to the rookie member, because one thing you touched on in your article, and again for my listeners, talking with Bob Callahan here about just some great training ideas in the volunteer fire service. Specifically, we talked earlier about rookie training ideas, and now we've segued into other ideas to make our training program just a little more well-rounded. But a lot of companies do try the mentoring program where they assign a mentor to a rookie member, not just for training, but more or less to get them familiar with the department's way of doing things. But I like how you put that in the end of the article, because you really talk about some important attributes of a good mentoring program. And I'd like for you to talk about that just for a minute as we wrap up here, because mentoring is sometimes easier said than done. And I think a lot of departments sometimes make mistakes by thinking they have a good mentoring program and it's not meeting the objective. So can you just cover real quick what you talked about in that part of the article?
Well, mentoring, again, goes back to planning. You have to decide who's going to make a good mentor. What skills do they need? What attitudes do they need? Do they have the time to be a mentor? Because if they don't have the time and the new rookie is trying to call this guy and it takes 4 days for him to get back, to them, that's going to be a problem. So do they have the attitude? Do they have the skills? Do they have the time in? Do they actually understand what they need to teach? Has the department developed a book or some kind of a guidance for the mentor so that he knows what he's supposed to say? So that mentor A doesn't tell rookie A this and mentor B doesn't tell rookie B something completely different. So the department has to take the time to develop some guidelines as to what they're going to tell the mentor, what they're going to tell the rookies. If they don't do that, you're going to end up with 10 different messages from 10 different mentors, which is going to create, again, a whole bunch of problems, a whole bunch of questions, and a whole bunch of confusion.
Yeah, and you can't force somebody into being a mentor either, right? You really want somebody that wants the job. Hey, Chief,
exactly.
I'd love to mentor the new members.
Exactly. You're probably going to find in a typical fire department there's probably going to be 3 or 4 people that want to be mentors. Most people aren't going to want to do it for a number of reasons. If you try to force somebody into it, they're not going to be very good at it.
And the mentor definitely needs to have the support and trust of the senior leadership as well. I've heard horror stories, and I've talked to people about mentoring before, about the chiefs being suspect of the mentors, that they're undermining the chief, and the chief then now starts saying things opposite of what the mentor's been saying, and it leads to the poor person being mentored. One person saying one thing, one person saying another, and you talk about dysfunction. Holy cow. So
yeah,
you really got to have your act together when you put a mentoring program together.
Yeah, it's very challenging to put together a good mentoring program. You got to find the right people and give them the right messages, or else you're going to end up with some issues.
Yeah, like put a template together, too, so you can ensure that a uniform, consistent message is delivered to the member joining 6 months ago and the member joining today and the member joining tomorrow as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Whew, boy, we covered a lot tonight about training rookies and senior members and getting everyone involved in training and motivated to show up. Is there any last words, Bob, that you'd like to talk about before I send you on your way tonight about training and what we can do to put a good program together?
Probably the biggest thing that I can say is look around. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to, when you go to a training session, and you run into somebody that does training for another department, don't be afraid to ask them, what do you do? Don't be afraid to use other people's ideas. If you try to develop everything by yourself, maybe you're really sharp and maybe you can do it, but for most people, there's a lot of ideas out there that you can take, you can modify, you can adapt, and you can use within your organization. And it'll make your life as a training officer a whole lot easier.
Yeah, good advice. Well said. And Bob, if any of the listeners wanted to get a hold of you, pick your brain a little bit about training, maybe learn some more information about your ideas for training rookie members, how can people get a hold of you?
Well, I'll give them my cell number. It's going to be area code 318-564-2561. Or if they want to email me, they can use my email address, which is all one word and all runs together, fireprevention officer11@gmail.com. And I'll be more than happy to help anybody out there that might want to pick my brain or might want to call me and say that they think I'm crazy. Either way.
And you're also teaching, you were slated to teach a class at FDIC this year. And I think you have an article coming out soon, Fire Engineering. Was it responding to small box fires?
Yeah, exactly. I have an article coming out in July, just like yours, responding to small box store fires with limited personnel. Every community has a Dollar General or a Family Dollar or a CVS pharmacy or whatever it might be. Basically, it's the 10 commandments of responding to small box store fires. So it covers everything from planning and preparation and training all the way down to what you need to consider when you're rolling into the parking lot and you got smoke or fire showing out of the building.
sounds great. And how about this? Can we make an arrangement maybe for a future show to have you on to talk about that?
We certainly can. I have no problem with that because, as I said, just about every community out there faces it. I don't drive through too many communities that don't have a couple of small box stores. So it's out there for every fire department in the country to have to deal with potentially.
Excellent, excellent. And I will pencil that in. I'll get a hold of you. We'll plan that down the road for a future podcast episode.
All right, that'll work. I had a great time talking to you. Hopefully inspired a few folks to think about their training program and maybe make some changes or maybe look at it and say, we got a pretty good program. I'm happy.
Yeah, at least they're thinking about it, right? Because as I said at the very beginning, it takes time, effort, and some forethought to put together a good training program.
Sure does. If you try to throw it together in 2 weeks or 15 minutes before the drill, it ain't going to happen very well.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for being on here this evening. And like I said, I look forward to talking to you again down the road, and we'll plan out another podcast.
That works for me. You have a nice night.
Thank you so much, Bob. You too, my friend. Thank you.
All right. See you later. Bye.
What a great show this evening. My thanks to Robert Callahan for being on, talking about training. Big focus on training our rookie members. So important to have a well-organized, well-structured training program. Folks, we are volunteering for something that can kill us. And I don't care if you're a scene supporter, exterior member, it doesn't matter. Even if you're showing up at the firehouse in some type of support role and you don't even leave the firehouse, it's still a very dangerous job. And we all need to train to be proficient at what it is we are expected to do. And a huge part of the training program is being organized, is having thought put into it, is accounting for senior members, accounting for those 10-year members, and also the rookie member. So go back, listen to it again, see how maybe you can structure your training program to maybe better facilitate those rookie members, see how you're doing about addressing what it is you're expected to be doing in your area. Check your skill set list, as Bob talked about. See what maybe you need to bring into your training program to make everyone just a little better and raise the bar just a little bit more. Such a great show of information with lots of information tonight, and I can't thank you all enough for tuning in. A little bit more information as I wrap up here. If anyone would like to get a hold of me, I encourage you to do so. My personal email is tamerrill63@aol.com. I mentioned my professional volunteer fire department Facebook page on every show. Again, I'm still drawing ever so closer to 10,000 likes. Please, 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 if you have not, give it a like. It's just a personal goal of mine. I want to get to 10,000 likes on my Facebook page, and that's the professional volunteer fire department. You can also see my posts on Instagram and Twitter, and I'd love to hear from anybody out there. Let me know what you're interested about talking about on future shows. Let me know about what's going on in your neck of the woods, what successes you're experiencing, what challenges you're experiencing in your hometown fire department. And let's all work together to make our fire service even better. Let's all have the badge of a professional firefighter. Hey, remember, folks, wash your hands. We're still staying at home for the most part. Take advantage of that extra time that maybe you have and read a book. Get a leadership book related to the fire service. Heck, it doesn't even have to be a leadership book on the fire service. There's so many good leadership books out there. Listen to these podcasts. Go online and learn so much more about this great profession of ours and make a difference. We'll get through what's going on. It's a tough time right now. Some of our brothers and sisters are really having a hard time with sick and ill family members, and some have suffered tragically, and we need to remember that and hold them in our thoughts and our prayers. And as I finish up tonight, again, thank you to Fire Engineering and Chief Bobby Halton for allowing us to do what we do, and we love to share our message via these great podcasts, so check them out in addition to mine. My next show is scheduled for probably July. I don't have the official dates yet, but I will get them out there when I do, and I can promise I will have some more great topics to talk about, including down the road. I'll get Bob back on to talk about the fighting fires in the box store with limited resources. I think that's a great topic for another day. So that's about it for this evening, folks. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen in. And remember, our residents are owed a professional service delivered by professional firefighters representing a professional organization. So thanks for tuning in wherever you happen to be from. Please stay safe, stay well, and we'll talk to you again down the road. God bless.